another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went.
Hi, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. One man's view of the changing world and changing economic times and what we can do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Today we're going to do a show on different methods of preserving food. A lot of my listeners are gardeners or hunters, fishermen, etc., that end up with large quantities of food, or maybe you even just are still buying the bulk of your food, but maybe you are buying in bulk during peak harvest times, or maybe you're buying at peak times for production in your region, like you're buying, you know, most of your tomatoes and your peppers and things like that when your local producers are able to provide them for you. And if so, you may have a strong desire to preserve those foods through the winter and early spring when they're a little bit harder to come by and certainly harder to produce for yourself. Or if you're a hunter, you know, maybe you want to be able to preserve some of that food, that meat that you bring in from the field in the fall and winter and be able to enjoy it in the summer when you can't go out and hunt. Either way, today's show is for you. Before we get into the topic, though, I'd like to issue a couple of reminders. The first one is we are running our listener appreciation contest. We have a goal of growing the show to 1,000 listeners by October 1st. We're well on our way there. We're over 20% there now. And I do believe we're going to make it. In return for your assistance in doing that, I am giving away at least one, if not two, free iPod Nanos. The way this works is if we hit our goal before October 1st, I give away an iPod Nano, and then October 1st, I give away another iPod Nano. If we hit it by October 1st, I give away an iPod Nano, and I'm going to tell you right now, if we're close, but not quite there near October 1st, you know I'm still going to give away one of them. So right now, there's only a handful of people in the contest, and you can go to the survivalpodcast.com. Click on Listener Appreciation Contest, either in this post or in the right margin, and just fill out that form and agree to tell at least one person by one of the methods listed about our show and recommend that they come listen to it, and you'll be entered into the drawing. And we do that by the honor system, so please be on your honor there. The other thing I wanted to point out is that when you come by the site, thesurvivalpodcast.com, if you'd like to be notified of new episodes, just click or just use the little form that's in the left-hand corner and give us your name and email. And every time I publish a show, you're going to get an email saying, here's a new show that's available, and a little very, very brief summary about what it's about. The biggest reason I do that is I cover varied topics. Today we're going to talk about preserving food. I just did a podcast on situational awareness that I haven't actually published yet. I don't know if I'm publishing before or after this one. I've done them on gardening. I've done them on libertarian ideals. I've done them on constitutionalism. I've done them on the rising oil price. I've done them on all different, you know, solar energy and green energy issues and things like that. So I know that all my listeners aren't interested in all those subjects. So by doing this alert list, you're able to see what the podcast is about. Tune into the ones that are most interesting to you. On some of the topics maybe you're not interested, hey, give me a chance. It just might make them interesting. So anyway, that kind of wraps up those announcements and reminders, and I want to kind of go on from there. One other thing I do want to tell you, I've had some server errors recently. If you go by the site, you get a weird error message. Come back later, try again, and it'll probably work. Don't worry, it's nothing malicious or any kind of script running. It's the server forgetting that it has PHP installed on it or something like that, my web host tells me, and hopefully we'll be through that little technical issue by the time you even hear this. I did want to point that out in case it becomes an ongoing thorn in my side, as server issues sometimes do. So let's go ahead and get into today's topic of preserving food. I'm going to go through about nine different methods of preserving food for the long haul. And only one really requires ongoing electricity, that's freezing. I'll be kind of brief with that because I know most of my listeners are looking for ways to be able to preserve food with, you know, if the electrical grid fails or if you live off-grid or if you have limited freezer space, you want to be able to store more than you can fit just in your freezer or even your deep freezer. So we'll focus more on these other areas. Some of them, like canning. I'm familiar with the canning process. My grandmother had me doing it with her when I was a boy. on occasion, but I don't can right now. It's something I'm looking to get us back into as we're continuing to produce more and more food from our garden, but I'm not an expert in it. But I can give you kind of some of my thoughts on it, some ideas and an overview, and really kind of the same thing with pickling. I do some very, very basic pickling that's not quite designed for long-term term shelf storage right now. It's more of a flavoring pickling, so I have to use the stuff that I pickle ends up in my refrigerator right now to make sure that it's safe. That's also something as I get back into canning that I'm going to get into as well. So I'll go over some of my thoughts on both of those methods. But just know, you know, I'm not an expert on everything I discuss. And a lot of times what I'm throwing out there is, hey, come on by the blog and comment on the episode. Throw your expertise and information in the comments section. One quick note on the comments. If your comment doesn't appear right away, don't worry. First couple times you comment, you're on a moderated status. Sometimes it takes me an hour or two to get back by and approve comments. But it will show up, rest assured of that. Well, let's move on from there. My first method of preserving food, this is one I do quite a bit of that I really like, is dehydration. And there's various forms of dehydration. You can do oven drying. You can use the various dehydrators that are out there. You can do sun drying as well. But I kind of lump them all together. And it's really a great way to preserve food, especially produce. And I really like sun drying. And there's a recipe I'm trying this year, and I haven't grown enough zucchini yet to try this with zucchini, but I read about this method in Mother Earth News, which is a great publication that I really, really have enjoyed reading recently. And what you do with your zucchini is you simply slice it about an eighth of an inch thick, and you dry it on screens in the sun, or you can oven dry it if you prefer. And you do that until it's crisp, so you can bend it and it'll actually break. You want to get rid of the moisture there. And these are supposed to be great. Dropped into stews and soups in the fall, and that's all good and well, but really what intrigued me is that this person said that these things are great to eat like potato chips. So my thought is when I do them, I'm going to toss a little bit of kosher salt or sea salt on them and maybe a little bit of herbs, and what's been reported is that when you do this with a zucchini, you know, if you've ever eaten zucchini before, it's not the most flavorful of produce, but supposedly when you dry them, it intensifies the taste, which makes complete sense if you think about it, because you're getting more volume on a lower area. So I think that might really be a cool way to dehydrate or to enjoy produce for a long time. And this person says you can store these just in airtight jars or containers right on the shelf, and they last for a full year. So that seems like a great use of a crop that produces very, very heavily. And I'm thinking that the yellow squash would probably store very well that way, too. It might be quite good as well. And I'm wondering what other vegetables. And if you have any experience with that type of a storage of vegetables or vegetables that you do that with, you know, kind of, again, post them on the comment section. Share with us. We'll let other people know about it. And I'm going to do some research into some other aspects of dehydration like that. See what other vegetables I can come up with that will, you know, dehydrate well that way and be edible without being in any preparation whatsoever, kind of like veggie chips. Some other things that I've experimented with dehydrating, one is peppers, and that works really good, really like drying whole chilies, and you don't really need to dehydrate or anything, but you just hang them up on a string in the sun. And I do that quite a bit, and I'm doing that this year with something I've never dehydrated before called cowhorn peppers. This is just something I ran by a few plants and threw them in the ground to see how they would do, and they produce a pepper that's kind of hot. It's not super hot, but it's too hot for me and my family to eat raw. They're kind of thin-walled. They seem like they're a much better seasoning pepper to be fried in with other things to give a little bit of heat without maybe the heat that like a Thai pepper or a serrano or something like that would add. So I'm drying those, and we'll use those for seasoning, and that's going to be a good long-term way to store those. Carrots I've done a lot with dehydrators, as I have green beans with the conventional fan-driven dehydrator. Those are great for saving for things like soups, stews, and other cooking methods. When they rehydrate, they're not anything like fresh, but they're pretty dadgone good. They store a long time, but they both get very, very hard, so they're not going to be something you're going to make good veggie chips out of. Carrots get very, very hard when they're dehydrated. And sun-dried tomatoes are something that people are paying a lot of money for, and if you think about it, all you need to do to be able to make a sun-dried tomato is cut your tomato in half, set it on the screen in the sun, and dry it out. Now, if you want to be able to store them without refrigeration, they need to be very, very dry to a point where they're kind of hard. You need to remove all of the liquid. The ones that you see that are soaked in olive oil, those, unless they're properly canned, that's not what you do with a sun-dried tomato. You don't can it, but unless they're heat-treated in some way and sanitized and sealed, they need to be stored in a refrigerator once they're open. So if you want to use sun-dried tomatoes, know that if you want to store them in dry storage without refrigeration, they need to be completely dry. And that's really, in all the dehydration methods, your enemies are oxygen and moisture. And what you're trying to do with the dehydration process is remove as much moisture as possible and then store them in as oxygen-free of an environment as possible. Another preservation method that was heavily, heavily used by the Native Americans was actually smoking. And to me, smoking combines dehydration to a degree with a very low temperature cooking method. Even if you use a cold smoker, they call them, where you have a firebox and then pipes running to your smokehouse where it's just smoke, there's still a certain amount of heat rise that goes on in there. I'm not going to go deeply into smoking because I can do a show on that. I probably will in the future. But smoking is a great way to preserve meats, and there's many meats that can be preserved by smoking. And then there's other meats that maybe can't be completely preserved, but what you can do is extend their cool storage life or their refrigerated storage life with smoking. I like smoking because it really makes food taste very good, in my opinion. So it's a method that I've seen used quite a bit. It's a method that I use, and it's something you may want to learn more about. And it's often used as part of a way to make beef jerky. And that, of course, will store very well without any refrigeration. And there's two ways to make beef jerky. You can smoke it or you can dry it in the sun. I'm not going to get deep into beef jerky either. You can also do it with oven drying. But it's an excellent way to preserve meat. And you can make jerky out of various meats. But the only thing you really can't make jerky out of are things like pork. Anything that needs to be cooked at a certain temperature to make it safe to eat, you really should not make jerky out of. So that's another option to consider for your meats, is making beef jerky. Much superior, I feel, to beef jerky is an African method of, it's basically dry pickling meat, and it's called biltong. And it is something that I have developed a huge passion for. I mentioned on another podcast a guy named Peter Hathaway Capstick, who wrote a lot of books about hunting in Africa and South America, mostly dangerous game hunting, and did a lot of chronicling of the early hunters' lifestyles and what it was like in Africa. And one of the small articles I read by him talked about this biltong stuff, and it's where I discovered it. And the first time I made it, I actually have never made a piece of jerky again. I like jerky. If somebody else makes it, I'll eat it. I buy it in stores occasionally for something to snack on, but when I have extra meat around that I want to preserve, biltong is what I do. And I'm going to give you the basic recipe. If you just go online and Google or search for biltong recipes, you'll find plenty of recipes, but this is basically what I've always done. The first thing you need to do is you need to cut your meat up, but unlike jerky, you do not want to cut your meat thin. You want to cut it thick. I usually cut it about 1 inch by 1 inch in thickness, and I usually cut the meat about 6 to 12 inches in length. You can vary that quite a bit, but you don't want to make it too thick, or the preservation process is going to take too long. The next thing I do is I salt it well, and it's good to salt it with like a coarse salt or a rock salt so that not all of the salt is absorbed by the meat, so that you can brush most of the salt off at a later time. I like to salt my meat till it's all coated well. I don't like to bury it in salt, but I like it all to have some salt on it, mix it around in a big tub or what have you, and get it very well coated in salt. I then let it sit in the refrigerator overnight. And the next morning, I'll then pull that meat out, and I'll brush a lot of the caked on salt off of it as I pull it out, and I lay it out on a cutting board. And then I'll sprinkle or spray it. I use a little spray bottle to do this just because it makes it easier to coat it with apple cider vinegar. And you can really use any vinegar. I just have found apple cider vinegar, and a lot of the people that I've read recipes from seem to feel the same thing, that apple cider vinegar seems to be, guys trying to run me over with a truck, folks. Apple cider vinegar seems to be the the vinegar of choice that gets the best taste in the end result. And then you'll want to liberally coat your meat with pepper and coriander. Once that's done, you've kind of done everything you need to do up to the point where you're going to dry it. Now, here's the big difference between biltong and jerky. Biltong is not dried in the sun, and it's not ever heated, ever. What you're doing here, again, is really kind of a dry pickling. When you're done with this meat, it won't look like beef jerky. It'll look almost like it's been mummified to a degree. And if you haven't ever tried this stuff, folks, go out and buy a pound of beef and try it. And just make some up and see what's like. Get a big, thick roast, something you can cut into large pieces. The less fat in your meat, the better for making this stuff. So now, once you've got that done, the method I use is I have an office at home, and if you do this stuff in an air-conditioned house where it's dry inside, you can do it inside. The other thing you can do is like hang it up and shade if it's not too hot outside, but you have to make sure that you don't have too much humidity or your meat can spoil on you or take a really long time to cure. And then another method, and a lot of people seem to be doing this online, is they make a box with some holes in it, some little holes, and if you search for biltong box, you'll see this, with like a 60-watt light bulb in there, not really enough to give it a lot of heat because you're just in a fairly large box, just enough to keep the air very, very dry. The other thing you can do is kind of run a fan on it. My personal method for hanging it is I take a rope with a whole bunch of knots in it that'll help keep the meat separated, and I just take common paper clips and bend them into an S-hook shape, put one side through the meat and hang them from the rope, and I'll have these, couple ropes dangling all the way across my office every year after I go out and shoot a deer or two. My wife thinks I'm crazy, but in the end I end up with this product that, folks, this stuff will store for years. I read one of Capstick's articles. He talked about finding a stick of it made out of Cape Buffalo that had been left in one of his game bags. And he said, while it was a bit dry, it was still edible, and it was over 4 years old. And, again, it's something you're really going to have to try and experiment with. Some people like it to be a little bit wet in the middle. Some people like it completely dried through. You can eat it just by chewing on it, gnawing on it. You can slice it up. You can use it for cooking. It's just a wonderful go-anywhere, highly preserved snack. Once I get mine completely to the way I like it, I like mine a little bit wet inside still, I just store them in any type of airtight container. I usually use kind of like a Tupperware container, and that kind of stops the drying process, and it just keeps great. And I just finished off last year's supply about a month ago. Secret about biltong, though: don't tell your friends about it, don't let your friends try it, because it will raid your house as soon as they know you make it. It is that good. So that's going to be kind of my biggest suggestion for a new preservation method that many of you have not heard. And biltong is wonderful made from beef. It's also wonderful made from most big game. Deer meat, elk meat, moose meat, anything like that makes wonderful biltong. Some of the best I've ever had has been made from American bison or American buffalo. So if you happen to be blessed and you ever get to go hunt buffalo, know that you should reserve some of it to make biltong with. In fact, I've gotten to a point now where I turn the majority of my deer meat into biltong just because it stores so well and tastes so good. The next method I want to talk about is canning. And my best advice I can give you with canning is just use a quality canner and follow the instructions that come with it. But I am going to give you kind of the basics of canning, because I think people that have done it might be like, duh. But a lot of people seem to think that canning is something that's very complex and very complicated. All canning is really about is heating the product and sterilizing the container to a point where it kills all the bacteria and any type of fungus or mold or any type of anything that could infect it. And then having an airtight seal so that the food can be stored on a shelf instead of a refrigerator. The best way to do this is with a pressure canner. There's what's called open bath or water bath canning. My grandmother used to do this, and she also did pressure canning for things that weren't high acid. To me, it makes sense that if you're going to can on a regular basis, go ahead out and get a good pressure canner, that's two words can be used interchangeably. Because pressure cookers are great for like tough pieces of meat. You just pressure cook them for a few minutes and they cook them as normal. It tenderizes them a lot, so it's a very versatile device. They are kind of expensive, up over $100, some of them close to $200 or $300, but I found them to be worth it. I know my grandmother used hers extensively. It's where I learned about them. But follow the instructions that come with whatever canner you buy. But the basics of it are, you put some water in the pressure cooker, you set your jars in the pressure cooker with the rings and the covers on them, and loosely, and then you run your pressure cooker according to the instructions and the time for whatever you're canning, because there's different times for different foods. And then you let the pressure off by removing this thing called a pick-cock or a valve, and you let it sit. And what happens is everything inside that pressure cooker ends up being the same temperature of steam, which is 240 degrees Fahrenheit, which is significantly higher than boiling water, including the insides of the can, which kills anything. There's nothing that can live in that that's going to be a pathogen to human beings. And then as it cools, since if you've never seen canning jars, you just go out to the store, look for canning jars, ask for some if you've never seen them before, but they're usually a two-part lid to them. There's a disc and a ring. And the disc ends up sealed, and then you screw the ring down to keep it from becoming separated. You check them later on, and that's really the whole process of canning. So it's not something that's that complicated, and if you get a good canner and follow the instructions, the first time you do, you're probably going to make a mess out of everything. You're going to use every pot and pan in the house, but eventually you'll develop a system, and you'll be able to put up some of your harvest almost on a weekly basis with canning, and that'll go a long way for getting you through the late fall, winter, and early spring. So that's kind of the whole deal on canning. Just know that canning is really a very cool way to preserve food long term. And, you know, everybody did it 100 years ago. Every household in America that had a garden was canning 100 years ago. It ain't that hard, and with a little bit of practice, you can get pretty good at it. Pickling is another method. And I want you to kind of expand your horizon with pickling. Pickling is not just about pickles. I think a lot of people are under the impression that, you know, pickling means taking cucumbers and turning them into pickles, either dill ones or sweet ones. And, I like pickles, and I particularly like sweet pickles, and that is one great method of pickling, but you could pickle anything. One of the things my grandmother used to make was called chow chow, or chow chow relish, as I've learned they call it in the South. And this was thick, chunky, pickled relish with just about everything that came out of our garden. She would have broccoli, cauliflower, carrots, beans, cucumbers, all of these things sliced up into large chunks and pickled. And what I've learned about chow chow and peppers and all these other things in there is that everybody's chow chow is a little bit different. Because people put different, some people make it spicy by adding some hot pepper, some people add garlic, some people don't. There's many methods of making chow chow, and you know, like I said, basically every home gardener that makes chow chow has their own version, and I've become kind of a connoisseur of other people's chow chow. And anybody tells me they make it, I want to either bum some or buy some, depending on the individual and what they want to do, because some people just won't take money for it. I'll always chuck a few bucks at somebody for a jar of homemade chow chow relish. And that's a great way to kind of take in that huge harvest. You know, usually what happens in the garden is you get a decent harvest all year long, and then right before the frost comes, or right at the end of the year season, if you don't get a frost where you are, you get this huge bounty. And it's a good way to put some of that together in a kind of creative way. Of course, everybody's heard of pickled beets. There's many ways to pickle beets. They can be very, very vinegary, and a lot of people don't seem to like them that way. But if you were to reduce the vinegar a little bit but still stay with a good pickling recipe, that's another thing you can do. And my favorite use for pickled beet juice is making pickled eggs. And those I keep in the refrigerator, because basically just chunk hard-boiled eggs into the beet juice and let them sit there a while. But of course, you could actually pickle eggs through in the full process. I'm not going to give you the lowdown on pickling. Just know that the final step of pickling is a lot like canning. And without that, most foods really are not considered very safe for shelf storage. So if you want to really get good at pickling, go online, look at some recipes, look at the procedure. But just realize, I guess, the awareness thing here is that pickling is not just for making pickles. That there's various vegetables that can be pickled that are very good. You know, sweet pickled peppers are awesome. Just awesome. And I even like to put those on pizzas. I learned that from a little Italian pizza place up in Pennsylvania when we were living up there for a while. They made a sweet pickled pepper and Italian sausage pizza that was amazing. So that's just another creative use. And I actually like pickled asparagus. And I know a lot of people aren't maybe big on asparagus, but if you like asparagus, try it pickled. You might be surprised. So that's another storage method. The next one I want to talk about is just basic, simple dry storage. There's a lot of stuff that you can buy or grow that will store well just in a bucket or a can. One of the coolest things I've seen recently is using the paint cans, the metal paint cans, for dry storage. And I can't remember what form I saw this on, but it was really cool. And this person bought some flour and some other things, sugar, salt, and some other things like that, and put them into these cans and labeled them. And the beauty of that is when you open one, you're only using a gallon at a time. And they're very inexpensive. They're like a buck and a half a piece if you buy, a dozen or more at a time. They're very easy to seal. The only thing you need to seal them with is a rubber mallet. And then there's these oxygen removal tabs that turn your gas into an inert gas. They're pretty inexpensive, too, and you can just drop those in with some of the things you would store in there, and they'll help convert any oxygen to inert gas and extend storage life. So I think they are a great way to store food. Now, one of the things I picked up in this thread, though, is, don't use those tabs when you're storing, like, sugar and salt, because they'll turn them into a brick. But apparently it works really good for things like flour. So you kind of want to do your own research with where you use those tablets or those tabs or not. This is something new to me, and I'm just now learning more about it. That's part of the podcast. Again, don't think I'm an expert on everything. I'm trying to make you aware of what's out there and get your feedback and improve the knowledge as we go forward. The other storage medium that I really like are food-grade 5-gallon plastic buckets with good sealable lids. You can basically take some rice and dump it into a clean 5-gallon bucket in the last year. And I use about a 5-gallon bucket of rice a year. So I can keep 2 5-gallon buckets of rice around and take my rice from one as I need it. And, when one's empty, just bring the other one out and refill the empty one with another supply and rotate it that way. And that way I always have a year's supply of rice on hand. Bad time, I might use more rice, so maybe I should store more. But that's about as much as I really want to store right now. And again, those are always things you have to make. But again, never discount simple dry storage. Things like dry beans, shell beans will store almost indefinitely. Dry grains, wheat, rye, barley, if you buy those whole, you can store those in buckets or cans. And, the Mormons have gotten the preparedness thing down to a science, and they always store a couple cans of red wheat. Or other wheat for making bread, if a tough time comes. So there's a big lesson there. But again, what I wanted to throw out mainly with this is that this 1-gallon paint can seem like a pretty cool idea. I'm going to have to implement that. And like I said, my big view of those is that since they're only a gallon, as you open them, unlike opening a 5-gallon bucket, you're only exposing a gallon of a foodstuff at a time. The next method is freezing. And you might wonder why I would even include freezing, because it doesn't take a genius to wrap something up in a Ziploc bag and throw it in the freezer. Well, there's an issue that needs to be taken care of when you're freezing vegetables. And I know some people are really looking for more ways that you can preserve your food without electricity, but hey, while you have electricity and while you have a freezer, it's a great way to preserve your food. And I found that a lot of vegetables are just a lot tastier if you freeze them than if you can them. For instance, properly frozen green beans, properly frozen corn. Those two vegetables, they almost taste as good as they do fresh from the garden. Almost, not quite. It's all about if you do it right. And the issue is that there's certain enzymes and proteins in vegetables that the freezing process doesn't stop. And they continue to kind of do their thing. And what will happen, like, if you freeze a green bean without doing what's called blanching it, you'll pull it out a week later even and eat it, and it never seems to get soft when you cook it. It just tastes strange and funny, and there's a lot of other vegetables that do that. Some will actually continue to spoil in a way, and some will just turn into something you really don't want to eat. Either of those is bad, so blanching is the solution. So what's blanching? Blanching's pretty daggone simple. Blanching is simply where you immerse the food in boiling water or steam it for a given period of time. And if you Google blanching vegetable times, and I'll put a link on the podcast as well for you to some tables, you'll get different times for different vegetables. But once you do that, you simply then take your vegetables and freeze them. And it will keep them preserved very well, and they won't deteriorate on you. And if you do that, like I said, with your green beans, your cut corn, and other things like that, it'll work very well. On blanching vegetables, though, there are a few vegetables I kind of wanted to bring up to you. First of all, there are three things that you just don't need to blanch. You can just cut them up and freeze them if you want to store them that way with no preparation whatsoever. Those are onions, peppers, and herbs. So on your onions, peppers, and herbs, you can basically just wrap them up in a Ziploc bag and freeze them. And I guess my only additional thought on that is when I freeze peppers, I generally chop them up to the size that I'm going to use for most of my cooking so that they're very easy and quick to use. And I don't have to kind of cut them. If you have to cut them once they're frozen, it seems to kind of degrade their flavor and their texture even a little bit more. So cut them before freezing to the size that you plan to use on for cooking. And then, you know, kind of when you're cooking something with peppers, put them in at the very last moment, so to speak, and you'll get a much better result, unless you're frying them down to, like, a flavoring for a base or something. And, of course, that doesn't matter. You put them in whatever your recipe calls for. There's also a couple vegetables that do have to be fully cooked. Those are squash, sweet potatoes, and pumpkins. If you want to freeze any of those, they have to be completely cooked before you freeze them. I don't really like to freeze any of them, and they all will store pretty well without freezing if you take care of them the right way with just plain dry storage. So that's another way that you can store things. Again, blanching for most vegetables is a way to get the best results. And even though it requires your freezer, again, as I've said, to me I prefer it a lot to canning in many instances just because the quality of the end product tends to be a lot closer to fresh for me than the canning process, which tends to take vegetables and cook them down to a degree where they seem a little bit overcooked. The next method of preservation I'd like to talk about, I'm only going to talk about briefly, because I'll probably do an entire show on this, because I could talk for hours about making country wines and homemade beers, but conversion alcohol. Beer and wine store almost indefinitely. In many instances, they actually improve with age. And I just want to give you an idea of some different wines that I've made in the past that are maybe a little bit outside of the norm with grape wine. I've made wine from dandelions. I've made wine from marigolds. I've made wine from blackberries. I've made various wines using other things mixed with honey to make meads and various forms of mead. And mead is maybe the oldest alcoholic beverage known to man. I've made apple wine. I've made elderberry wine. I've made blueberry wine. I've made strawberry wine. And I even made hibiscus wine. I've even made jalapeno wine. And I've made raisin wine. All of these things are really cool ways to put up some wine for drinking on those cold winter days. And if you're not a drinker, you're not a drinker. I just thought I'd throw that in because it is a way to harvest and preserve a lot of things, especially a lot of things like wild berries make some great wines. Wild blackberry wine is really, really good. And a lot of places where wild blackberries grow, they're really not the greatest in the world for fresh eating because they're very seedy or maybe quite small, but they make great wines. So that was just something else I'd throw in. And then, you know, kind of the last method of storage, and this is something that almost every home in America had, was the root cellar. And they're not very common today, and I'm not going to go deep into how to make a root cellar or anything. Maybe, again, I'll do a whole podcast just on root cellars. But it's something to consider. It's something to investigate. And most people could put a root cellar in somewhere. And if you think about it, a root cellar is simply a hole in the ground with proper ventilation and a proper floor. No one said it has to be something you could actually walk into and move around. It doesn't have to be 10 foot by 8 foot or anything. You could make a small pit that acts as a root cellar, and I've seen some things like that. So these are just some methods of preserving foods. I got a couple phone calls during this podcast. I'm going to try to edit most of that out. I had some adventures on this trip. I'm going to actually listen to this one myself. If you're listening to it now, that means it all worked out. If not, I'll retape this one. If I wasn't 100% on game with this, give me another chance to listen to another podcast if this is your first one. Again, my name is Jack Spirico. This has been the Survival Podcast. We're here to help you figure out how to live a better life. Times get tough. We're going to figure out.
You can scream and you can holler, it really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.